Hey, John here. Before we start, I just want to give you a heads up. This episode contains descriptions of sexual and gender violence. So if that hits close to home, please be careful. You're listening to Road to Resilience. I'm John Earl. This past July, producer Katie Ullman and I went to New Jersey to visit a man named George. He's this gentle giant of a guy, mid-30s, tall and sturdy, with a big smile. If you walked by him on the street, you'd never guess that just recently he was locked in a jail cell, fighting for his life. There are about 70 million forcibly displaced people in the world today. 70 million people means 70 million resilient stories. And today on the podcast, you're going to hear one of them. This is the story of a man who risked his life to be himself and of what happened when he came to America and asked for asylum.
I came to the United States to seek asylum because I'm a gay, and Ghana, being a gay, is not allowed. And so that was the main reason why I left my country to come to the United States.
Do you remember when you first realized that you were gay?
First realized I was gay, that is when I was in my primary education. Mm-hmm. And I have a friend, which his name is Isaac, very close friends. We bath together, we do a lot of things together. So it's like I became interested, but I didn't know whether I was gay or stuff like that.
Isaac was older, British born, and George fell for him. They'd meet up in the showers late at night when everybody else was asleep. It was George's first relationship, and it was beautiful. But same-sex contact is illegal in Ghana. And even though prosecutions are rare, homophobia and anti-gay violence are common. So when another boy noticed that something was going on between them, it was only a matter of time before the culture caught up.
One guy in our dormitory, he was like monitoring us, and one time he intentionally was quietly open the bathroom door and saw that. For so most of those in our dormitory came over and they reported to the housemaster, in which we were severely caned.
The boys were caned and expelled. Isaac moved back to Britain, and George found himself completely alone. His community and even his own parents started treating him like an outcast.
And was there anything in the culture that was affirmative, that was said it was okay to be gay?
No. In Ghana, in Africa, they hate gay talk. They see, as I told you, they see you to be like evil. I don't know how I should say it. They won't get close to you. Friends, family, all those around you, even getting a job is very difficult. Very, very, when they get to know you, you're going to be sacked. So it was like hell for me.
What happened at the school would happen again and again. First he'd meet somebody, then they'd become intimate, and then inevitably, somebody would find out. That's what happened with Larry, George's partner in his mid-20s. They met in the capital, Accra. Larry gave George a tour of the city and they became friends. To understand what happened next, you have to know something about George's family. George's dad is an advisor to the local chief. He's a big shot in the community, and he's not afraid to use violence to get his way, even if you're his only child. And George's dad did not approve of George's sexuality. He wanted George to live a traditional life, and so George lied about who he was. He explained all the rumors away, and for a while it sort of worked, until the day George's dad caught him and Larry fooling around. What he did is hard to hear, or even imagine a parent doing to their child.
He shouted, and most of the guys in those in our community came and they beat us severely with metals and humiliated me. About 2 hours, it's my mom and those one or two people in our community, and also my mom begged my father, and in which he forgave me and gave me a warning that if I don't change, he's going to do worse.
After this part in the story, who could have blamed him if he decided that being himself was just too dangerous? But that's not what George did. In fact, he did the opposite. I almost couldn't believe it. George started organizing. Every month, he drove 250 miles to attend meetings of an underground gay rights organization. At the meetings, he and his friends dreamed aloud about making Ghana safe for LGBTQ people. And even though that dream seemed far away, they had hope.
You had this dream of bringing people together despite the threats and the violence. Like, what gave you the courage to do that? Can you put your finger on it?
I was having a hope. I was having a belief that with time it will come to an end.
People will come around.
Yeah.
Society will change.
Yeah, that was the main reason why I still, even no matter what, I was still pushing.
That was until an incident that happened in late 2017. One day George was listening to a panel discussion on the radio. The panelists were talking about a recent murder in which a gay man had been killed by anti-gay thugs. George listened with horror as the panelists praised the killers, saying the victim got what he deserved. George was so offended that a few weeks later, he did something he says he never does. When the station did a call-in show about gay issues, he picked up the phone and he called in.
I told them, like, what have we done? We pay our taxes. We don't cause any threat to the community, stuff like that. So why are you guys doing that to us? So I said it in a harsh way because I was hurt. And for what I said, those panelists also got annoyed. They gave my information, my number. And they said that when my life got threatened.
When George called in, he had to give his name, number, and location. Standard stuff. They never, ever read it on the radio. Except this time, to get back at him, they did. And a few days later, the thugs came for him.
They came to my house, threatened that they were going to kill me. I wasn't around. That's when I got to know my life was threatened. So I left the place immediately. I took a drop into Accra, which is about, from Takoradi to Accra, is about 5 hours. I left to Accra to stay with my aunt, uncle.
So that was the moment when you realized that you had to get out of Ghana?
Yeah, that was the moment I realized I have to come to the country. I got to the point that if I don't leave the country, my life, I will be killed. So I have to.
With his decision to leave Ghana, George joined the 70 million forcibly displaced people. And on a cold, cloudy day in March 2017, he landed in New York City. That's when his journey to safety took another unexpected, terrifying turn.
I came to the United States on March 23rd and I made them know about my situation and I was arrested.
Immediately?
Yep.
Right at the airport?
Right at the airport, I was arrested. Yeah. Like they were having a gun on them, and even they were threatening me, stuff like that.
Was that a surprise to you to get that reception?
I was scared because I didn't know anybody in America, and me coming to America and I was told I was coming for safety, and I came to, they're shouting at me at the airport that African, that's what you do, and you because you want to come and stay in America and stuff like that. If I don't say the truth, they'll put me in jail, and like the same where they have been threatened at Ghana, that they will make sure I'm locked, put in cell here in the United States, and I was really scared.
And what happened next? Where did they take you?
They took me in a van. The van, from there, there's a van at the street in front of the gate. So I didn't see an American, nothing. I was just put in the van to the detention center.
Because the immigration system is overwhelmed by the number of asylum seekers, applicants often have to wait months or even years for their cases to be heard by an immigration judge. And increasingly, the government insists that they wait in immigration detention rather than out in the community. So George found himself at the Elizabeth Detention Center, essentially a jail for migrants, with no clear idea of when or even whether he'd get out.
I think one of the things about being in detention, an immigration detention center...
That's Dr. Elizabeth Singer. She's director of the Mount Sinai Human Rights Program.
That is really upsetting and disturbing, is this level of uncertainty. You don't know when your case is going to come up. You don't know how much longer you have. Mm. I have a personal experience which doesn't even begin to compare to anything that you have gone through in a detention center, but that I had gone to see a client there at Elizabeth, and that I was in a room with a detainee and had done a physical exam, and we were behind a locked door, and the detention guards were supposed to come and let us out, and they forgot about us, and we were stuck there for about 25 minutes and, you know, banging on the door and really not clear when we were going to be let out. And that was just a very profound moment and a really small glimpse into what it's like to, you know, not know what's going on.
While George waited for his court date, he worked with his lawyer to gather evidence that would corroborate his story. A forensic evaluator from the Mount Sinai Human Rights Program examined the scars on George's body to evaluate their consistency with the mechanisms of injury that he described. The clinician also provided a mental health assessment to document the long-term psychological effects of the trauma that he experienced. Conditions at detention facilities across the country vary widely. George said one of the hardest things was the fact that nobody calls you by your name.
I was never called by my name at the detention. I was bed 25. So they'll call you by your bed number until the visitor came and called me Joe. That's the first time I felt somebody's calling by my name. And it's horrific, man.
And so what are you thinking as you're there, kind of day after day?
I don't know how to express my... It wasn't easy. It wasn't easy because I was having a belief. I thought it's going to be like giving a place for me to stay, for me to go to court and stuff like that. I didn't know I'm going to lock up in a one place without sunshine, being locked for 7 months. The food is very bad, and you have a time you have to sleep, you have to wake up, you try to do anything that without, like if you try to do and complain a lot, they'll put you in shoe.
That's an acronym that stands for Special Housing Unit. What it means in practice is solitary confinement. ACT UP, and that's where you go.
Did you ever end up in the shoe?
Almost.
What happened?
One time I was really depressed. I wanted to even do something to myself. So I was just frustrated, I was depressed. So I just took a pen on my bedside and I wrote from Ghana what I've been through my life. It's like I wasn't, anytime I try to find happiness, then something comes in. So one officer saw it and reported me you don't have to write on the wall. And two officers were taking me to the show, and the way I started crying, the officer saw me and said I should go back. And just advised me I shouldn't. He knows that I'm being depressed, you know, but I shouldn't give up, and I should be strong, and everything will be fine.
Believe it or not, this is not an uncommon story. The guard who whispers, "Stay strong." Lots of migrants I've talked to have this story. It's this beautiful glimmer of humanity amid all the uncertainty, and it came just when George needed it most. Finally, after 7 long months, the big court date came. In the courtroom that day was George, his lawyer, and the government's attorney. There's such a shortage of immigration judges that the government has them essentially Skype in from across the country. George presented the evidence he and his lawyer had gathered while he was in detention. There was no room for error. Misremembering one date or a small inconsistency could be the difference between asylum and deportation. After about an hour, the judge turned to the government lawyer.
The judge said, "I think I'm consistent." He asked the immigration attorney, "So far, how did he see me?" And he said, "It looks like I'm consistent." So that's when, after they said, "Welcome to America." Mm-hmm. So after I was in front of the judge, I was like quiet. But when I got outside, I said, "Thank you."
How did you feel? I'm just curious. Okay. How did you feel with this juxtaposition of like welcome to America when you got asylum, but you know the whole time you were in detention being treated so poorly? How did you reconcile that?
It was a different feeling. One was a different feeling altogether. Especially when truly I was released and I was out having my luggage, and that's when you feel it. That's truly you're out. I don't know the first day when even I did not sleep when I came. the first day I came out, I did not sleep. I was like on my bed thinking about my life. When I thought all is over, and when I was depressed, and then now at least I'm okay and I'm free. That's it.
I don't know if like how closely you follow the news or what's going on with immigration right now. I was just wondering what it feels like to be, you know, someone who's received asylum in this climate right now where there's a lot of people saying nasty things about immigrants.
If you're not being treated, if we're being disciplined, we're doing our thing, I think they should allow us, you know. Trust me, since I came to United, I tried to behave. Like, let me use myself as an example. I tried to behave. I tried to do the right thing. I tried not to cause any trouble. I tried to be careful with my life. If not, you guys will come and visit me. I'll be in my room just listening to music or stuff like that. So I don't think we've not been treated to the country or stuff like that. So,
and what do you hope people who hear this recording understand about you or about migrants to this country?
You should understand, if not what we've been through, I would have stayed in my country. If not what we've been through. My friend of mine got bent in Ghana for him being a gay. It's okay.
Well, I think we're very lucky to have you here. Yeah. And I'm so happy for
Thank you.
And I'm happy for the life that's opening up in front of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, George, for trusting us with your story. And thank you, Dr. Singer. Road to Resilience is a production of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. It's produced by Katie Ullman, Nikki Hudson, and me, John Earl. Our executive producers are Dori Klesis and Lucia Lee. From all of us here, thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.